You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Dardane, and I represent the tenant and the guarantor in this appeal involving a commercial lease. There are two issues before the court today. The first is whether the trial court erred in determining that an unsealed lease for a term of more than 5 years satisfies Virginia's statute of conveyances. And the other is whether the trial court erred in determining that there was consideration for a guarantee underlying that lease. Very briefly, by way of background, in this case, the landlord sued the commercial tenant, the Game Place, for non-payment of rent, also sued the guarantor, Mr. Lightburn, based on a guarantee or a purported guarantee. The lease at issue was a 15-year shopping center lease, and it was not signed under seal. The defendants, appellants here before the court, filed a demur and argued that before the trial court. The demur claimed and asserted that the lease was unenforceable under Virginia's statute of conveyances, which is found in Virginia Code Section 55.2. In relevant part, that statute provides that no estate for a term of more than 5 years in lands shall be conveyed and left by deed or will.
May I ask you this? What's your best response to the assertion made that 55.51, which incorporates all of Chapter 4, Title 55, the savings provision, is applicable if you take into account 55.57, which is the form of lease provision, which doesn't require a seal, but does mention that a seal is part of the recommended form? What's your best response to that?
Well, I've got it's found in the text of 55-51. If you read 55-51 and actually apply it, it is essentially meaningless in this case. And let me tell you why. 55-51 provides that, in relevant part, any deed or deed of lease which shall fail to take effect by virtue of this chapter. So, first, it's got to fail to take effect as by virtue of Chapter 4 of Title 55.
So the point there is 55-57 doesn't require a seal, so therefore you're not violating 55-57 if you don't have it.
So in that case, it doesn't. The chapter doesn't even apply because we're talking about a common law seal requirement.
Well, their best argument is right, but 55-57 at least nods towards it.
It does, but look at the entirety of Section 55-51, and let's talk about what it actually means. Any deed, and let's take your argument. Let's assume that there is a requirement.
Well, it's their argument.
Let's take their argument. Let's assume that there is a requirement in 55-57 that there be a seal. Let's say that's the requirement. There's a seal. It's in 55-57.
Right.
Read the entirety of 55-51. What it says is, and let's call it a lease for purposes of this, any lease which shall fail to take effect by virtue of this chapter shall nevertheless be as valid and effectual and as binding upon the parties thereto, so as far as the rules of law and equity will permit, as if this chapter had not been enacted. So what does that say? Well, that says if there is a seal requirement in 55-57, which incidentally is entirely permissive, it says a lease may be according to the following form. But let's assume that that is a statutory requirement, and let's assume it required that a lease be under seal. If you read this, what it says is, you know what, as between the parties then, we're just going to pretend that the provisions of Chapter 4 never existed. We're just not going to apply them. So what happens if you remove the provisions of Chapter 4? You're exactly where we are. We've got a common law seal requirement that was relaxed by Section 11-3. So I fail to see any way that 55-51 has any application to this case.
You win, of course, without going quite that far.
Sure.
Under your theory.
Exactly. We don't even need to get there because it's not a requirement of Chapter 4.
So if the 15-year lease were unenforceable under the statute of conveyances, some periodic tenancy would be implied, right?
And that's what this court said in Granville, is that you've got a tenant. If the tenant actually takes possession under an unsealed lease that fails to satisfy the statute of conveyances, then you do create a tenancy. It's a periodic tenancy that's measured by the frequency of payment of rent, which in this case was monthly. And then that lease becomes terminable under 55-222, by providing 30 days advance notice, written notice of the termination of the lease, and that is what the parties did in this case, and that's in the record before the court.
What is the significance of the tenant estoppel certificate?
I don't see any significance to the tenant estoppel certificate. You know, a tenant estoppel certificate, and in this case, that tenant estoppel certificate was issued to provide some information to a lender. And the idea behind a tenant estoppel is it stops the tenant from taking certain positions contrary to that tenant estoppel with respect to that third party who's relying upon the tenant estoppel.
Okay.
So in other words, it would allow the lender to assert a claim of estoppel to a change in position. As it pertains here, however, the argument relating to the estoppel shows up in the consideration piece of this argument, but I'd like to point out that, number one, they're not a third party relying on that tenant estoppel. Number two, estoppel was not pled in this case. And number three, the guarantor did not sign. That was simply a tenant estoppel on behalf of the commercial tenant, not on behalf of the guarantor.
Was the guarantor the one who signed it?
Yes, the guarantor signed it in his capacity as a member of the corporate tenant. The guarantor did not sign it in his capacity as a guarantor, and it makes no reference to a guarantee. It doesn't purport to make any representation with respect to a guarantee, which, of course, is found in a document that's separate than the underlying lease.
Am I right that if the 15-year written lease is downgraded under the conveyance statute to a month-to-month periodic tenancy, then the assignment issue is really moot?
It is. That's correct. And of course, as your honors know, what happened in this case is that the common law seal requirement was relaxed by Virginia Code Section 11.3 that allowed certain substitutes for a seal, including if you've got a document that says this deed or this indenture. On demurrer, the trial court overruled the demurrer on the ground that the lease satisfied Section 11-3, the relaxed seal requirements, because the lease, and I'm quoting from the trial court's letter opinion, which was incorporated into the demurrer order, could have just as easily been entitled deed of lease or lease indenture. In other words, because the lease could have said deed of lease or deed or lease indenture, then the trial court treated it as if it did from a basic standpoint of logic. That analysis doesn't make sense. That's like saying, under the statute of frauds, the fact that an agreement could have been in writing means that it was in writing, and you effectively gut these statutory provisions if you take that approach.
What do you make, though, of the implication from the trial judge's gut reaction that the expression, other words importing a sealed agreement, what meaning do you give that? The trial court apparently gave the meaning, well, it's a big, long document, it's single-spaced, and it's full of ink, so it looks sort of formal.
Yeah, he says it's good enough, basically, because it's lengthy.
Well, what would you say those words should be, the other words importing a sealed instrument? What magic words were those?
Well, you can have for example, in the Pasco Steel case, parenthetical seal. That can satisfy the seal
or
requirement.
Or the Latin LS.
You can say, witness the following signatures and seals. That can satisfy a seal requirement. But none of that exists in this particular lease. And yes, it is a comprehensive 17-page lease. Keep in mind that in Granva, it was a comprehensive lease that I believe, in the words of the court, had every provision you could anticipate in a lease. And the court invalidated that lease as not being signed under seal.
So other words importing a sealed instrument would be the typical conventions used today, you know, which are actually mentioned in 5557, the Latin expressions that have been used as synonyms for seals.
Precisely.
But not simply that it's a written agreement and it looks pretty comprehensive.
Exactly, because what is it? The seal requirement existed at common law because what you wanted to do is recognize the importance of certain documents. So there is a historical significance to a seal. And Virginia, I think that over time, the Virginia statute has, the Virginia's General Assembly has relaxed that seal requirement, but it hasn't eliminated that seal requirement. So there's got to be something that signifies the significance of this document other than simply the fact that it's in writing. Otherwise, the General Assembly would have just said, if it's a signed written document, it satisfies the seal requirement. There's got to be something more. And just because it's a lengthy document doesn't give it that something more.
Let me preface this question. I mean, our job is to follow the law wherever that takes and not worry about the consequences to the market, generally speaking. But how common is this practice in your experience? I don't know that there's many of these long-term leases out there, but is it common for landlords and tenants to just be more casual about this?
In my experience, I will tell you that if I have a lease that's more than 5 years, it says deed of lease on it. I also will say that in the marketplace, what you typically see are five-year renewable terms.
Right. I was going to say that seems to have been adopted as a practice, that you make 5 years renewable and then you dodge whatever this statute means.
And it may be that practitioners these days don't recognize that was the genesis of the five-year renewable term, but I think it probably was. And keep in mind, too, that if this is a marketplace issue, then the General Assembly can, if this is perceived as a problem in the marketplace, the General Assembly can very easily solve the problem by either further relaxing the seal requirement under Virginia Code Section 11-3 or altering the statute of conveyances.
If we have to upset the apple cart, and you're saying we probably wouldn't, I think we have to follow the law, but it's good to know if it is going to upset the apple cart or not.
Certainly. With that, I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal unless there are any further questions from the court. Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Glazer. I represent the landlord in this transaction, Fredericksburg 35. As with every case, context matters. And I can tell from the justices' various questions that the context in this case is certainly very important. And in this case, for 12 years, this tenant occupied this property. For 12 years, this tenant paid rents. During that time,
but the law accommodates that context by saying that if a lease is in violation of the statute of conveyances, it's not that either equity or law looks the other way. It's understood to be a periodic tenancy, which either side can walk away from, including the landlord. And you got to pay for it if you stay there. It's not like people are getting ripped off in this kind of consequence. It's just adjusting it to pattern itself after the common law rules.
And in looking at the common law rules and what the General Assembly has done in Chapter 4 of Title 55, we see two things. And Your Honor's question as to 55-57 was one of those, but I think you have to look at it in conjunction with 55-48. And that's because 55-2 provides that any conveyance of more than 5 years must be by deed. 55-48 instructs us what a deed may contain. And it lists very similar things to 55-57. A grantee, a grantor, property description, consideration. But conspicuously absent is a seal.
Well, both 55-48 and 55-57 talks about things that may be in a deed. Neither one talks about things that have to be in a deed, and the savings provision says if it has to be in a deed because of anything in Chapter 4 and it's not quite right, look the other way. So doesn't the may word eliminate your conclusion?
No, Your Honor, because the may word in 55-48, if the construction is that these things may be in a deed, but even if they are, the deed itself could fail, would certainly turn 55-48 on its head. 55-48 provides that every deed and corrected or amended deed may be made in the following form or in the same effect. And then it gives a very brief paragraph. The very clear implication is If those elements of 5548 are present, it becomes an effective deed. And measured with 5551, together those provisions are step one. 5548 requires certain, or permits certain things to be in there, and if they're all in there, it's a deed. But if one of those is missing, or if one of those is not quite right, but the parties understand what the document is, it can be given effect, then 5551 steps in.
Well, can I read 5551 to you again? It says, look, if the deed, the lease, whatever, if it fails because you violated some statutory requirement in Chapter 4, then don't worry about it and treat it as if the chapter had never been enacted. Well, if the chapter had never been enacted, there'd be the common law, and the common law required a seal. So you see his logic. I'm trying to understand how anybody can get around it.
Certainly, Your Honor, because 5551 has an additional provision, which talks about as between these parties. It sets up the line of landlord and tenant on one hand, and third parties or outsiders to the transaction.
That doesn't help you, because it's limiting the saving provision only to the inter-se parties and not to third parties. So it's not a broad savings provision for everybody. It's just between these two guys, landlord and tenant. That's all that's saying.
And as between landlord and tenant, it does not state the original signatories. And the significance there is the 801-279 provision. We pled in our complaint that we are the successor in interest to the original landlord. The original landlord, Amusement Central Park Limited Partnership, in our statement in the amended complaint, paragraph 4, and then paragraph 5, stating that we're the successor to the prior lessor.
Well, let's assume you're an assignee and you're the successor, which is a tough question under assignment number 2 anyway, but let's assume you're all right. The successor to an unenforceable contract inherits an unenforceable contract. He doesn't get an enforceable contract because he shows up after the party's over.
I would agree. If it is unenforceable on day one, I would, however, disagree that it is actually unenforceable on day one. To answer the other question as to the effect in the marketplace, I do want to address that briefly. We know from at least 3 circuit court cases that are in our brief, McHugh, Hasso, and Mormon, that this is a fairly common occurrence. There's no evidence below as to the 5-year option. As someone who represents a fair number of landlords, I would actually disagree with that conclusion. In fact, it seems to be more of an economic issue where a tenant doesn't want to be tied to a particular property. That's the driving factor of the 5-year option concept. But what the circuit courts have done in those 3 cases, and we've not seen anything to the contrary, is to apply 55-51 if the term deed does not appear in the caption, or if the term seal does not appear in the document. And what's very significant in this case is that the tenant did not testify, the guarantor did not testify, there was no evidence of any kind as to the importance to be attached to those terms, whether it's the word seal or the Latin LS.
It seems very formalistic, but it's in the code, so we have to navigate it.
I would, again, disagree that it does not appear in 5548. The term seal is absent from that. The term seal does appear in the permissive language of 5557.
So let me ask you this. Whether the parties appreciate the significance or whether public policy thinks there's any continuing role for seal, it's not that complicated. I mean, these are sophisticated parties with counsel, I assume. There's so many ways the legislature's given you to get around it. You can just use the word deed, 4 letters of one word, and we wouldn't be here today. You can use the word indenture. You can use a scroll. You can use words that sort of sound like you're saying sealed. You can use the Latin maxim. You can do all sorts of things. Why should the court straining at these statutory schemes to help commercial parties when they're obviously not even looking at what the rules are?
I would point the court to the Corbin case, Your Honor, and the Corbin case provides neither statutory nor common law requires a grantor to employ words of art so long as the intention to grant is so manifest on the face of the instrument that no other construction could be put upon it.
Well, there's no doubt there was an intention to do a lease. The question is what was sealed.
Yes, Your Honor. However, in the absence of any evidence from the tenant or guarantor importing any importance to that language, the rule announced by this court in Corbett would certainly seem to trump that no magic language is required. Where a tenant or guarantor appears and says, I read the lease, but I didn't see the word seal, so I believed that this was not such a solemn and important document. Perhaps in that case, the rule in Corbett would be different. But we don't have that in this case. As to the second assignment of error, the lack of consideration argument, the guarantee is supported by adequate consideration. The claim by the guarantor is in fact not a true lack of consideration claim, but a lack of standing claim. The argument is the entity that signed the assignment, which contains the guarantee, was not at the time the landlord, and that somehow the inquiry as to whether or not consideration flowed must be foreclosed because the wrong entity signed. That's an incorrect analysis. First, paragraph 6 of the assignment, which contains the guarantee, provides in part that provided the landlord consents to this assignment, guarantor agrees to personally guarantee the obligation. What's missing there is a statement as to how the consent is manifest. Here, consent was manifest through action. On the very first day that this tenant was given occupancy, the landlord certainly has given his consent. The landlord accepted rents. A couple of months after permitting the occupancy, again, consent by action, in May of 2003, the landlord issued a demand for increased rents under the lease. The tenant paid that increase. Again, through action, consent to possess this property has been manifest. There was a question as to the tenant estoppel certificate, and I do want to correct a statement that was made by the appellant. The tenant estoppel certificate does make a reference to the guarantee. The tenant estoppel certificate specifically identifies the assignment of lease, and this is in the appendix at page 251, as being in full force and effect. The guarantee is contained within that November 15, 2002 assignment. The estoppel certificate was signed by Mr. Lightburn in his capacity as a member of the LLC entity, but certainly by this 100% owner. Consideration means not so much that one is profiting as that the other abandons some right. Here, the landlord abandoned the right of possession. Occupancy was granted to this tenant. This tenant enjoyed that occupancy. Consideration's passed. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Briefly, with respect to the Corbett case, that had to do with words of conveyance. The law is clear that in order to have a deed, you've got to have words of conveyance, execution with a seal, and delivery. The Corbett case dealt with the words of conveyance aspect of the requirements for a deed. It didn't deal with the seal requirements. So that case really does not apply here, where you have a very clear common law requirement of a seal, and it doesn't exist. And whether or not there's evidence before the court about whatever significance the parties paid to it really is not relevant. The issue is, does it exist or does it not? 55-2 says it's got to be in the form of a deed. If it doesn't have a seal, it's not in the form of the deed. And this court in Granva said that means that you haven't conveyed any interest in the property, which is why the law says you create a periodic tenancy measured by the frequency with which the tenant pays rent.
The Virginia UCC, am I right, the Virginia UCC abolished entirely the seal requirement and didn't they have saving statutes, just abolished it flat out.
I believe that's correct.
So if we're hypothesizing what the General Assembly's intent here, is they're incrementally chipping it back in the real estate world, but they're certainly not abolishing it.
Not yet. And real estate is still an area, as you know, with the statute of frauds, where there are greater degrees of formality. To Mr. Glazer's point about 55-48 not having an explicit seal requirement, that's because for a deed to be recorded, it has to be notarized, and a notary is a substitute for a seal under 11-3.
Are there statute of limitations that turn on sealed versus unsealed instruments?
I don't believe there are anymore. I don't believe there are anymore. But I believe in the past, I think it was a 6-year statute of limitations for a sealed document and then 5-year for a written contract, but I'm not certain of that. So statute of conveyances, it exists. This court has enforced it, and it should be enforced here. The tenant in this case, and I've cited in our rebuttal brief, a document that's not in the joint appendix but is in the record before the court, which is a notice of termination. It was joint trial exhibit number 6. And what that did was give notice of the termination of the lease on May 29, 2014. And so that's proper termination. The lease was a month-to-month lease, terminable upon 30 days notice under Virginia Code Section 55-222. That 30 days notice was given on May 29, 2014, so the lease would have terminated effective July 1, 2014. And for those reasons, we believe that the trial court's ruling should be reversed and judgment should be entered in favor of the defendants. Thank you, Your Honors.
Call the next case.